Anybody home?
What kind of party is this, anyway?
A very strange party, if you'll pardon the expression.
Radio General Erko.
Yes, sir, but that's not what's so peculiar.
Put it on the bridge speakers, Lieutenant. Pay more attention.
DJ 7 L.
I thought it might be static, but not on every channel. Tend to sound like...
Holy Mountain Printing Podcast.
Hill.
Hear me and hear me.
Wait a minute, what's that?
I demand an explanation.
Look at that one, bigger than the rest. He looks like...
Invasion by creatures from space confirmed. New York City may be their next objective.
Just stop.
Strange reports from
sick bay level. What way
strange? Holy Mountain Printing Podcast.
Listen, Governor.
Welcome to the Holy Mountain Printing Podcast.
Let's get into it.
I apologize in advance. I've been on. This is not an exaggeration. I was on 3 hours straight of web calls at work this afternoon before doing this. So if my voice sounds shot, that's why.
Yeah. Do you ever lose your voice through screaming, or do you often lose it just through like speaking to people for hours? Because I never lose my voice necessarily from like playing shows, but it's always from just like talking on the phone for hours.
Oh, I definitely lose
it. It just ruins me.
Yeah, I lose it through playing shows, definitely. Although I've sort of figured that out in recent years, you know, finally at this age. But if I'm just talking all fucking day, I get tired and I definitely sound grosser than usual. And husky and horrible. And every time I'm like that, I'm in the back of my head, I'm like going, oh, why do I play music in a band? Because I can't even be on a call for 4 hours straight at work without losing my voice. So I can never yell in a band live ever again. So, but yeah, I have that all the time.
I think like having to speak over someone in a live environment or having to talk on the phone seems to be way more straining than screaming, to be honest. I mean, like, I think it depends on the type of screaming. I think, like, It seems like punk bands and hardcore bands, like, just yell as hard as they fucking can. And then, like, you know, all the goofy metal guys have, like, all their stupid-ass weird techniques.
Well, that's the thing I learned in recent years. Like, before I was, for years, I was just too fucking loud. And I realized because I was so loud, there was very little in the way of enunciation I could do. Because
I mean, fuck enunciation.
But you can't, you know what I mean? Not enunciation, but like it literally just comes out.
Yeah, there's like no diction at all.
But you can't do anything because you're just like forcing as much air out as possible, which kind of can be cool sometimes in a live show because people are like, what the fuck? But you can't do that on tour because it just fucks your voice and recordings just becomes boring and you sound the same all the time. That is I'm a very weak vocalist though.
I mean, I didn't have my own thing until I figured out, well, for one, one of my best friends is like a huge Acid Bath fan and he was always into that like pukier style vocalization they do sometimes, but he did it all the time. Okay. And I just thought he was like my hero when we were kids. You know, he's the guy that got me into all the music I got into. So I totally copped his style and then kind of realized all the black metal guys, like it's more of like a head voice.
That's
so
quiet.
He just screams so much longer. It's like crazy.
All those dudes are whispering, those black metal dudes. That's a weird pukey voice. I've done that a few times on recordings and it's like, I'm in the studio just like holding a fucking SM57 whatever, just like rolling around on the floor doing it and like pretending to vomit. And there has never been a time when I've done it where I haven't immediately felt like vomiting afterwards. It's like,
oh yeah,
if like I have to, like, every fucking time I do that I feel like puking.
Yeah, like for any of the newer stuff we've been working on, where it's more like somebody else is going to build the song afterwards. It's kind of a thing where I have to like track a whole bunch of vocals, and then yeah. I just kind of by the end of it, I'm just trying to make like some retching noises that they can sample if they want. And I definitely like get close to just feeling like I'm going to throw up. It's like not cool at all. You're just amazing. Like this isn't even close to singing. What the fuck am I doing?
Yeah. So we've definitely started this conversation, which is cool. Should we introduce it now that we've started talking? So you are Dylan Walker of the band Full of Hell and Sightless yep. Pit. And you can introduce me.
And that's Andrew Nolan from Intensive Care, Endless Blockade, Column of Heaven, Wolf of Graham, 100 million other things.
Yes, 100 million other things. Wolf of Graham is the name I produce hip hop underneath.
Yeah.
Not just my cool social media handle.
Yeah, it transcended that.
Yeah, that's why I did that. I had a different name at first, and then I was like, I should change my social media so it's like related to the hip hop stuff. And then I thought, rather than change the name of my social media, I'm just going to cut out most of the just personal stuff and bullshit from it. I'm just going to change my producer name to Wolf of Graham. So I did it.
I'm glad you did that. As opposed to just like starting fresh, because honestly, a lot of times I see my buddies that are like struggling with their art and they're like, I made a new art page. And it's like, nobody wants to follow the new art page, man. Like everybody loves you and the art and the music is amazing. Like just stick to whatever. Like, it doesn't fucking matter.
Yeah, it's cool. It's like turn your regular page into your art page, and I'll just look at your stories where you post pictures of beer and your dog.
Yeah, like, that's what happened.
That's cool. I'm fine with that. It's okay. But you know, when I'm like so and so posted a message, I'm like, who the fuck is like Happy Boy 69? Like, who is that? I'm like, oh, it's Bill. Like,
dude,
yeah,
I can't be trifling with people that change their handles every 3 months. I'm like, I don't know who you are anymore.
Yeah,
so I never changed mine. And I actually do all my mail order through just like the Instagram handle now. You know what I mean? Just like The Vault. And it doesn't even mean anything. It was like just a little nod that I liked when I was younger.
Dude, my email address is still theendlessblockade@gmail.com.
As it should be. Is it The Endless Blockade?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was the name of the band. We had a thing in the early days where we were going to... We never did this because it would have been too much work. But when people did our name wrong on a flyer, like when they either called us Endless Blockades or Endless Blockade or some other variation, we were going to like play a completely different set and style of music. So if like, you called us Endless Blockade, not the
Endless. So you're going to get the other set.
You're going to do it. Like we're just a full set of Funeral Doom, just like 1 hour, one song.
Damn, that's a power move.
we couldn't do it though. It would have been too much. I mean, we could have just done like a Posh Noise set, I guess, but like, fuck that.
I mean, you can't have been booked by that many dickheads. I feel
it was in the early days, you know, when we just started.
Of course.
No one cared anyway. So
we've been called like Full of Fuel one time
full
in
of
France.
Fuel.
I think there was some weird thing.
France is weird like that, though.
I think there's some weird thing with adverts in France where they're like not actually allowed to put profanity on like big billboards for some reason. I could be totally wrong here, but like any marquee would say like Full of Something. And it was Full of Fuel one time. And we've been offered tours like to open for bigger bands where the agent will call us like This Is Hell, which was a hardcore band that doesn't sound anything like us or like something like that. And then they wonder why we just don't respond. That's like step one, like got to get the band name right.
Yeah, agreed. How long have we known each other for and when did that happen?
I know we were
talking about this the other day, but
we got in touch because Full of Hell were huge Endless Blockade fans from day one. Uh-huh. And Spencer wanted to put Noise stuff into Full of Hell, like right around the time I joined, which is right in the beginning. And, you know, obviously we were really into what you guys were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first Noise recordings we made, we sent to you for feedback. Mm-hmm. And we both knew that you had like strong opinions about music and that you were probably a person of knowledge that we wanted to talk to, whatever you think about that. And you actually responded and you were really like even tempered and cool about it. And I was just like, damn, that's pretty sweet.
I think that was about 10 years ago.
I remember
reading the email and it was on my way to work and it was a specific job I only had for about 18 months. So I definitely remember responding to it. bizarre to me. But I respond to almost every email or direct message I get, most of them, almost all of them, because I feel like if someone, also I'm no one, like, who cares, like, if someone reaches out to
none
me
of us are anybody really.
Yeah, but none of us
you
are
should
anybody,
always take the time
but particularly me, and so I'm always like, you know, I'm always like, if someone reaches out and they have a question or they're like, hey, you know, I respond to it, and I try, you know, I'm nice about it, and I know I've definitely had a reputation that sometimes is being opinionated and rude, and sometimes I am. But that's definitely an act that
I mean, we want to.
You know, if someone's like going, hey, I like your band, I'm not going to be like, oh, cool, fuck you. It's like, thank you. That means a lot. I'm like, that means a lot to me. That's the only response you can have. I'm also not going to be like, going, yeah, man, my band's sick. It's like, no.
I mean, I don't think the perception of our age group was ever like, Andrew's a bully. It was just like, here's a guy that will be honest with you because he's not afraid to, like, just, you know, have an opinion about something, because I have trouble with that too. It's mm-hmm. definitely hard for me to, like, want to just, like, I would never want to just, like, step on some kid's project that he's working on, even if it's really bad, because they're just starting out, just like, you know, all of us,
yeah,
you know, continue to learn. I would never want to just be not productive and just be like, this shit fucking sucks. That doesn't solve anything. It never did.
So I've made a lot of bad music in my life, and I continue to make bad music. I'm usually smart enough to catch how bad it is and not release it now. But I've made terrible music, and it's fine. And I remember part. I don't really remember what you sent me, but I do remember my comment was, because you want to be constructive, and I didn't think it was garbage. I didn't think it was amazing, but I didn't think it was terrible. But I'm not going to reply, yeah, this fucking sucks. I'm gonna be like, yeah, try this. And I think I remember saying, just be more judicious with your editing. I think
of course.
I just said that, like, you know, just when you're recording noise, and that's a thing that so many people do with noise, and I have done it many times myself, and a lot of the noise releases I've done over the years haven't been that good. But people don't listen back to it and go, this section at 4 minutes is cool, but then this section at 7 minutes, sort of, you can hear it goes boop as we dial the
dials
around.
Angle.
Yeah, like, always cut that shit. And anytime I'm recording something at home now, and I'm, you know, you're in the moment, and I catch a part where it goes boop, I write it down, go back and edit this part out, because I don't want to miss it. I think, yeah, but that was our first contact. Like, so that was about 10 years ago. And since then, we toured together, what, 5-6 years ago, Column of Heaven
and Full of Hell.
Full of Hell. Jesus Christ. Yeah. Column of Heaven and Full of Hell. Sorry. It's been a long day.
Column of Heaven, Intensive Care. That sounds like a headache tour for you.
Where you have
to do both.
God, that would be awful.
Yeah.
Column of Heaven and Full of Hell, and that was just on the cusp of you guys, and I want to say this the right way, transitioning from being like a basement show, back of a record store kind of band, into a bigger shows, more sort of attention from the press, and a more well-known band. And you had that aspect then, but I think that tour we did with you was probably one of the last times that you were able to play a basement show or like a small, you know, like a small show like that. And none of those shows, all the shows were like well attended, but I feel like that was, we got you just at that final point in Full of Hell.
I think that's fair. And I remember that tour was like a badge of honor for us. I remember texting Spencer when you were like, we're in, and being like, dude, we're going, I know this is going to make you cringe, but we were like, dude, we're going on tour with these guys. I can't fucking wait.
Yeah,
like, it meant a lot to us. And
the whole tour,
I'm just saying, it was really cool for us. But the best part of it was, like, I felt like it wasn't, I mean, who knew if we would have all gotten along? But, you know, particularly you and Dave, I've just been, like, you know, extremely close with ever mm-hmm. since.
Yeah, it
was a great tour. We were really particular, I feel like, about who we allowed to handle the shows, because we just wanted to do stuff with our friends.
Yeah.
I thought it was an exercise in just, like, kind of trying to do a tour the right kind of way. We definitely, there were some drunk buffoons here and there, but we can't.
And that was often me and Dave.
Yeah, I mean, mostly Dave. Let's
be... I have my moments.
Legendary.
But we'd met a bunch of times before that. I remember you were playing a show at Sneaky D's in Toronto.
Ken
and
Mode.
Invited me out. Yeah, the Ken Mode tour, and I came out to that show. So
yeah, like, you made a cameo.
I'd seen you guys a few times. Also, I forgot about this until yesterday. I played bass for you guys at one show on that tour.
Oh, fuck.
Because
yeah.
Brandon couldn't get that over the awesome. Border. Yeah, that was so fucking weird. I forget that I played bass for you for one show, so I'm technically X-Full as well.
That's my favorite Toronto show we've ever played, and probably will play.
That show was crazy.
The Soy Bomb show.
Yeah.
What a perfect place.
That was a venue that closed down a couple of years ago, unfortunately, when the alt-right started. Calling out
right in the middle DIY of the floor. Venues.
But yeah, it was like someone's apartment, a bunch of people's apartments, but they built like a skate ramp into it, and they just cleared out most of the apartment and sectioned it off. And it was just, there was so many people in there. The problem with that place is it was a fucking death trap. Like if there was ever a fire now, it would be a nightmare.
Single file right down the staircase. Oh, that's the only way to get out of there.
Yeah. Just terrifying. I remember booking Column of Heaven, Iron Lung, Shit, and a couple of local openers in there, and we had almost 500 people in that place, and it was
holy shit,
fucking terrifying. You couldn't move. It was very, very scary.
Because I feel like there was maybe 200 at our show, and
there was a lot.
That is so many fucking people for this place. Like it was so crowded, and the floor was the whole. Building basically felt like it was shaking.
Cool. We did that. What else have we done to get to, I think I sang on one of your albums. Which album did I sing on? The one with the
Trumpeting Ecstasy. That's 2016.
I did a song on that. It was the Ashen Mesh. Was
that the name of that one? And you sang the really long monkey beat part.
Yeah, I do the middle part. I did my Glenn Benton impression.
It was awesome. That rules.
And then we did. Then Intensive Care and Full of Hell did a split sandwich together a couple of years ago. Was that 2 years ago? 3 years ago?
2 or 3 years. Yeah, it's hard to say. That's right before we were going on tour, and we sold those like very, very slowly on tour because it was one pressing, which we did. I feel like that's a split that went in and out before anybody knew it was there. You know what I mean?
It did.
There was no effort.
Yeah, we still had copies when we did that Full of Hell. And not Full of Hell. When we did that tour with The Body and Uniform, like maybe a year, maybe less than a year after, we started some copies and we sold five at each show. We deliberately only put out five at each show because we didn't have many. But yeah, we always sold them because it was someone who was buying it for Full of Hell, not for Intensive Care. But hey, fuck, we got the five.
I see a lot of young kids like learning what's up, though, honestly. And I think it's all the stuff that you guys have going on and stuff. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's just been exciting. Like for me, I felt like Full of Hell was the like band for the young kids that mm-hmm. even when we started playing with The Body, a lot of young ass like kids that are into hardcore and metalcore and stuff like that had never heard of The Body either. Mm-hmm. And I noticed like a lot of younger kids that I don't think would ever have had the palate for something like The Body or Intensive Care actually taking the time and wanting to like at least wear the t-shirt, let alone, you know, listen to the music. And I think either of those things are positive. I always liked that. And I don't know. And now I see The Body getting lots of people into lots of those young kids into other shit. Like Lingua Ignota, she's like super, super hype now, but like I heard about her through Chip and Lee. And it was just cool to see those guys bump bands. And I was so psyched that you guys toured with them. I don't know. It was really sick.
I think the lines are not quite as sharp and well-defined as they used to be. And I personally really do like that. I think a lot of people of my generation, so people who came up in the early 90s hardcore DIY scene and have stuck around, there's often a lot of complaints about, you know, everything's too fluid now. I'm actually really into it. Like, I like the fact that you can be a fan of Full of Hell because you've read about them. I'm going to say Decibel magazine, but that outs me as being old because I'm pretty sure that's not where most people get their music knowledge from now. But you can be into Full of Hell, but then you can move very easily to some shit like the Rita, which years ago was like so many levels removed from that. And you had to know who it was. And then you're like, oh, wait, how do I get this cassette that was made 35 copies, and I kind of like that it's easier to do that now. It's I think it's interesting. I don't know. I think that's cool.
I think it's a positive, huge positive. The more kids that are going to get into it, the better, you know?
Yeah. So I don't want to spend too much time on this because I suspect you're being asked this a lot more than I am, because I don't do podcasts very often, like once in a blue moon or interviews that right. often. But we are talking in the middle still of the COVID-19 pandemic. And also, I don't want to talk about this too long because, you know, listening 3 years from now, people are going to be like, what is this? so we're in the middle of this pandemic. Because people don't know this possibly, I'm living in Toronto, in Canada, and I'm in week 9 of the lockdown here right now. I wanted to ask you, how has it affected Full of Hell and what you've been doing musically since? Because I know that you've had some stuff canceled, and I know it's more impactful to you because your band makes more of the band that I play in doesn't make that much money for me. I don't rely on it for my income, the music I do. But I know it's different for you. So like, how has it impacted you, the COVID-19 stuff, and what have you been working on?
I mean, it's kind of shocking because, like, I think about it, like, I joined Full of Hell when I was 19, and literally from the moment I joined, the goal was, let's get in the van and go on as many tours as we can and make as many records as we can, and we literally never stopped, and now I'm 30 years old, and so it's, like, a blur. I don't even, like, the decade, looking back, I know this is totally a normal feeling, but looking back, it feels like, you know, simultaneously, like, a blur in, like, a million years. But seriously, I don't even know where the time went. And it's such a habit now of going on tour that when this stuff first went down and I really started to realize the gravity of the situation, that's when I was, you know, I started panicking. The first couple of weeks, I was like, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. Like, not even monetarily, because none of us rely on Full of Hell as our only income source. Mm-hmm. It's definitely an income stream, but like, we can't be stupid. We play like extreme music. We want to keep it exactly as we want the music to sound. So we got to have other hustles going on. So like, that really wasn't a huge concern for me, but we spend so much time working on all the tours we do that, as they canceled one by one, it just felt worse and worse. But honestly, at a certain point, the final tours of the year, we just decided to just cancel, and some just canceled as, you know, without our say, and we just kind of let it go. So, it's actually been really productive, though, to be honest. We're working on all these projects that were already on the back burners to be worked on this year. But now we can kind of like relax and do them to their fullest extent. You know, like we're putting out a double LP, a reissue of our first two records.
That's coming out tomorrow, right?
We're going to put up the pre-order tomorrow.
Oh, okay. The pre-orders are tomorrow.
On Wednesday, May 20th. And we've been working on that for ages. We were actually working on it before we ever got robbed last fall. And we didn't want to put it up right after we got robbed because we were like, everyone's just going to think we just took all this money that we got donated and just spent it on a double LP, which wasn't the case. We owe the plant like the full bill. So we waited and it was going to come out in time for Roadburn, but honestly, man, everything's cool, everybody's busy, all the boys are working, I'm like printing shirts and doing all this stuff and working on lots of Full of Hell stuff, so I don't really feel too upset about it anymore, you know.
Did you write your second album? I know you've been talking about that.
It's the next Full of Hell record is like pretty far along, way farther along than it would have been without this. I mean, Spencer's written most of the songs, I think. But because we have like a few recording projects, I think he's like banging them out one at a time.
Yeah.
And we're actually having our first band practice at the end of the month. Not this weekend, but next weekend. So I'm going to drive down there and see those guys and stay down there for a weekend, and we'll run through all the new songs and I'll demo them, and then I'll get to work on lyrics and stuff. So I think the hope, though, is that like, I don't know if you have this feeling every time you make a record, at least like maybe even when you were younger more so, but like ever since I was young making records, I always felt like I didn't put enough time into making sure I did every little thing I could do. And then once it was out in the world, you know, I lived with those, you know, perceived flaws or whatever they might have been. So as we've gotten older, every record we're trying to take more and more time, and we still are pretty bad at it since we tour so much. But for this one, I don't know, we're just I mean, it's so far written by now. We're just going to keep rehearsing it and refining it for a long time. And I don't know. It's nice to take time. I think that's like the core positive.
Yeah, I'm not a perfectionist at all in music. I do. I'm happy with it being raw around the edges.
Yeah.
Particularly because for the last 10 years, probably, I've only recorded my own stuff, so we don't go to studios. The studio is in intensive care. Is me and Bloomer, my other half in intensive
pressure,
care, just
the studio
doing stuff. It does. And my philosophy for the last 10 years has been, if someone's not going to do full justice to my vision, it may as well be me. Like, I don't want to pay someone else to do a recording and mixing and me not be happy with it. Like, I want the fault to lie strictly within me. I don't want to have an excuse of this guy did a bad job of mixing it, or the studio sucks. Like, I want it to fall on me. So it should be my responsibility. So if it doesn't come across the way I want it to, it has to be my fault. So that's why
that I started
recording stuff. But I also think, to your point about, you know, feeling you don't put enough effort into it, I think, like, for me, I think you should always want to do better. And I think it's healthy to release something and be like, I don't know, I would have done that differently, and keep doing that. I never get, like I say, I'm not a perfectionist, but I never get too
content,
fair with stuff.
Resting on your laurels.
No, I always want to kind of push forward and stuff. And
that's kind of critical to progression in general, is to not be completely self-depreciating.
Yeah.
Well, for Full of Hell, it definitely is. I think Spencer sometimes borders on maybe a little too extreme with how hard he is on the music that he's written. But the reason that we're so productive and driven, I think, is largely based around the fact that he is like that. He's like very, very self-critical. And I'm pretty critical of our stuff too. I definitely cannot go back and listen to Full of Hell records necessarily. You know, I don't really want, I do when I'm required to, or when I really feel like maybe I could glean some wisdom from it, but it's not something I like to hear. I don't like the records we're really re-releasing. I don't want to ever fucking hear those records again, probably, because it was a time and place where I wasn't at a performing level that I felt like I should have been at. But it's always going to feel like that, probably, to a degree. You're right. I don't think it's ever going to go away. And I think it's generally maybe more of a strength than some inherent weakness or something.
Yeah. For our own stuff, COVID-19 didn't really hurt us in the same way in terms of impacting the,
what's your situation like up there?
Well, Bloomer and I, are both, considered essential service workers. So, our income hasn't been impacted. The way we work has been a bit, band wise, we had tracked about 75% of our album, and now we can't finish it because of social distancing, and we can't be in the same room together. Bloomer has a young family. I don't want him to get sick because he's been in a room with me.
Of course not. It's not worth it.
So we've had to put the LP on hold, which fucking sucks, because if we'd finished tracking it, this would be a perfect time to spend time mixing
mix
it at home. I could do it here. So that's been impacted, but we've been working on a couple of things piece by piece. We've got a weird industrial dub kind of project we've been doing that I think is almost done. And then we may have the beginnings of another project after that, depending on how much longer the lockdown stuff is going.
Right.
For my own stuff, I've been working on a bunch of hip hop, and I've done a couple of different full albums for different people during lockdown. And I've been doing
Falcon Outlaw stuff.
Yeah. Falcon Outlaw, Sully Nomad from New York, Chuck and Locke from Delaware, Garbage Face from local guy. Started working on a second album for Luke Sick, from the Bay Area. And then I've been doing on a collaboration with Mike from Uniform through email. It's coming along well, actually. I think that we're both sort of surprised how it's coming out. And I feel like that's probably almost ready. Maybe another couple of tracks to do, but we're close to finishing that. Then we just have to figure out how we're going to release it, what that's going to look like. So I've been busy with music, but I'm always busy with music. Like, there is literally never a day when I don't do some some form of music, and that's because a lot of the stuff I do is so like electronic based now, and a computer that I can just turn on the computer and work for an hour, and I've got somewhere with something. So I'm always working, and I have a bit more time now because I don't have to travel into work. I'm working from home. So that's given me like 2 or 3 hours of my life a day back. So I don't have to get up as early. I don't have to come back from work. As soon as I finish work, I'm home. So it's helped with that. But yeah, the intensive care thing is kind of a pain because I would really, really love to finish this album that we've been working on.
Yeah, of course.
But you know, whatever. It'll happen when it happens. It's fine.
Do you feel like it's a huge stress reducer that you don't even have to leave your apartment right now? I mean, I feel like that's kind of conducive to a good creative environment, not having to, I don't know, the whole, I don't know what it's like for you, but I don't really get inspiration from being in like a stressful moment or like a grievous moment, like when I'm grieving or when I'm angry or stressed out. I'm not creative at all. I'm just like overcome with, you know, whatever is ailing me at the moment. And if I was to be allowed to work from home as I'm able to do here, I don't know. It just feels like such a less stressful environment. I don't know if I could create if I had to do like some kind of community work where I was having to go out every day. And I don't know. It would just stress me out, especially like in the city. I don't know. It's just so congested.
Yeah. I mean, I think the difference in your situation and my situation, you live out in the countryside, and how far is your nearest neighbor from you?
I mean, a couple hundred yards, but still, it's right. I mean, it's spread. Everybody's.
Yeah. I live in a huge, like Toronto is huge.
Yeah.
It's busy. I live on the 15th floor of an apartment building. I have a dog. I have to walk the dog 3 times a day.
Yep.
Go in the grocery store is a fucking nightmare. Neither me or my partner drive. So we're picking stuff up and carrying it home so we can't just, you know, drive to a grocery store and do a month's worth of shopping at a time. That sort of stuff sucks. About the creativity and stress, yeah, I'm not someone who's like, I don't, you know, if I want to stick my fist through a window, I'm not saying like, perfect time to write an album. I'm not that person. I'm a fairly analytical person. So I live on the train track. So you may hear a train going past my apartment right now. I'm a fairly analytical person. So sometimes I do tend to pull things apart a lot in my head. And I do find that analyzing previously stressful situations helps me with the creative process. Like certainly the first few intensive care records are written about my experiences with having post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah,
through a previous job, and that has been very, very helpful to me.
That makes sense to me. It's more of a cathartic, you know, analyzing of a situation that maybe you're no longer in. Because when I'm in that situation, it's just like I'm just trying to cope.
It doesn't help, like, you know, picking up my bass and screaming doesn't really help much.
I guess I never understood that when that was like the. I feel like that's a stereotype. Like, I'm fucking mad, somebody punched me so I can fucking freak out and write an angry song. I just never understood. I don't know, when my heart's broken or when I'm hurt or something, like I just can't write.
Well,
I stop.
Column of Heaven had a song about that on the first demo called Binge and Purge, and I think the first line is catharsis is a point or a circle.
I remember.
And the idea was, my thing is, I don't really think too much about this now, but at the time I was thinking a lot about the nature of catharsis and angry music, and I thought, so what? Catharsis doesn't mean anything because it doesn't solve anything, because, you know, you get angry about something, then you're cathartic, which means you let it out, but then you bring it all back in again. So
yeah, it's a circle.
Yeah, so I don't use the word catharsis in my own output because I don't find the concept of catharsis to be helpful, because you empty, so what? You empty, well then you're just gonna fucking drink it all up again.
So you literally don't feel as though catharsis is cathartic at all.
Well, it's an emptying, but with that emptying usually comes you take it back on again.
So refilling,
so I think there has to be a different level of of understanding for me. Like for anyone else, it's fine. I don't like whatever you do. You.
Yeah.
But for my own stuff, yeah, I don't. Catharsis to me isn't a helpful concept for me because it doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah, I don't know if it does for me either, and I don't know if I could even color the emotion that or the energy that like I put into the music. I know like our bands sound extremely angry or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know how they're perceived by anyone else, but I can't even put a label on the energy. It's definitely like an exercise in pushing out energy that feels very, very, just like freeing and good and healthy. But I can't even say it's like necessarily angry or any sort of way that it might sound to an outside perspective. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's almost just like, it's just nebulous, like indescribable, just energy. You know what I mean?
I don't consider Intensive Care to be an angry band. I think there is hostility. The way I set up the way I write lyrics is kind of hostile, but the content of it is usually not. And the content is generally about working at like the politics of work and what that means.
That's interesting.
The way I tend to deliver that, the way Intensive Care set up was we have like a lot of power electronics influences, but those influences don't necessarily come across in the audio, but sometimes in the approaches and the mentality. And to me, the best power electronics, the narrative is around power dynamics and imbalances. And the smartest power electronics, I think, does that in a good and intelligent way, and the worst of it is just like fucking dumb whores, kill them all, like, and like,
yeah, seriously,
whatever, like absolutely no interest in that kind of shit.
Yeah.
But I think the smartest stuff, things like IRM from Sweden has an interesting take, and there's a lot of like medicalized stuff in IRM's work.
Yeah, it's not so blunt, like in a narrative sense.
Yeah, so for me, Intensive Care, like the powered imbalance that I interrogate through that is work, because it's about the politics of work, yeah, mostly. And like I said, a lot of I have diagnosed PTSD from a previous job that I was doing until relatively recently, but a lot of some thinking has come through that, and I kind of switched it around and have rewritten things. And it's helped me to understand it. And I write it from a decidedly shit-headed perspective, because I don't think power electronics is supposed to be nice. And I'm a very political person, and I would be written off as a boring social justice warrior by many people. And I don't fucking care, because I will also punch you in the fucking mouth if you're an asshole.
Yeah,
I'm not a peace loving hippie at all. But so I am political and I am a right honor and all that. But I don't think that everything needs to be sanitized horribly, and I don't think everything needs to be packaged up neatly and nicely. Also, having said that, I also am very critical of stuff that's just honestly embarrassingly fucking lazy, and much of the shit-headed aspect of musical culture is just fucking lazy, like go away.
Yeah, not only like kind of just like ignorant in a really stupid way, but like insanely derivative.
Yes,
so it's just it's like the repetition of stupid ideas that don't even need to be said for whatever shock value they're being said for in the first place.
Yeah, it's like, oh, your project hates women, okay.
I actually had an eye-opener the other day. It was a bit of an embarrassing situation for me with Full of Hell. So when I was like around the time I met you, I wanted Full of Hell to have, you know, X aesthetic, like, you know, whatever edgy thing it might be. And one of the shirts I printed really early on was this picture of Chris Farley right after he died, you know, overdosed, horrible.
Was that the Numb Your Mind shirt?
It says Numb Your Mind. And I felt like the context to me was like, holy shit, like this guy that brought me so much joy when I was a kid and growing up was so fucking sad and so tortured, and like, look at this, it sends this like really heavy message, but it's not tasteful at all. And as an adult, I'm like straight up, you know, totally horrified by it, to be honest. Like I don't really like that we made it, but there was like a time a week ago where a lot of kids, we saw a lot of kids were just like, you know, if we're going to reprint an old design, you should reprint this one. So I was like, fuck it. Maybe we should just reprint it. And as soon as I posted it online, I immediately got a message from someone that was like such a kind of poignant, just kind of nice, respectful way of saying like, how would you feel if blah, blah, blah. Yeah, and yeah. I didn't even need to read it before. I was just like, I fucking immediately I regret this. This is not me at all. And it really doesn't reflect anything that my band has ever been about, even from day one. So I just like had to take it down. I was like, this is the stupidest fucking shirt. And I don't know. It's just not us, you know?
I have that in my own musical history. I'm just like, yeah, I wouldn't do that now. My own like sort of realization with that kind of stuff was, quite a long time ago now. But it was one of these, like, I understand what this is and what it means to me, but what does someone who is not versed in this world that I'm in, where you have to be kind of initiated into it, and by initiated, I mean, you have to have a certain level of knowledge to understand the reference points and the language that's being used to see what it is. And I was working at my job, which at the time was a Glasgow Drug Crisis Centre, and Glasgow has a huge, huge heroin problem. I worked in that place through, I think, three outbreaks of necroticizing fasciitis through infected Afghanistan. Horrible, horrible. Of a world of deeply, deeply depressing jobs that just fucking kill you, not because of the work, but because of the fucking pain that you are exposed to, and the fucking just the shit. That's the number one, and I've had a few. Maybe that's number two. That's not the job that gave me PTSD. That was a different one. But I was at that job, and I was wearing a Septic Death T-shirt, and I remember I was on a night shift, and I looked at my shirt, and I'm not embarrassed about wearing a Septic Death shirt. I still own a Septic Death shirt. I'm happy to wear it. But I remember looking at it and I was like, what do people in this environment think of when they see me wearing a shirt that says Septic Death? And it's like, they're not going to be like, oh yeah, cool. You know, it's like classic hardcore band and you're probably into this, this, and this. And they're not connecting the dots. I'm like, no.
They're seeing like someone trivializing these real struggles.
And I don't think that their band is called Septic Death because of anything. But, you know, I'm working in a place where people are overdosing. People have got lost limbs. It's just like, that was my realization with that. And I was just like, I have to be, I don't want to be say careful, but I have to pick and choose what I wear and when I wear it. And there's certain things, certain shirts that I just won't. Bands, I just won't wear it. Like, I'm not interested in wearing it. Like, it's not because I'm embarrassed, but it's just because, you know, I'm a fucking 46-year-old man, and I don't need an autopsy lyric on the back of my shirt because, you know, cool, but I don't want someone reading it as I'm like doing my grocery shopping.
You don't owe anyone anything. And I hate when people say that, but I don't think there's anything wrong with just taking a little bit of social responsibility. And maybe feeling some empathy for those around you. And, you know, honestly, I've always been a really empathetic person. And I don't know, like doing a shirt like that for me, just like it didn't really line up with who I actually am as a person, which is something maybe I'm a little more aware of than I was 10 years ago. And I just wanted, you know, to have this band that's just like super crazy. You know what I mean? There's a little more to it than that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with accepting that maybe sometimes you need to make the tiniest little social sacrifice, maybe to make others around you more comfortable. And obviously the pandemic is like a big eye opener, but I don't think I'm just saying, like, situationally speaking, recognizing that Septic Death shirt might like trigger some people in your workplace. I don't think that's a lot to ask to make that choice for yourself and just be like, all right, maybe I won't wear this at work. Like, whatever. Like, it's not a big deal.
Yeah. And for me, and honestly, whatever someone else wants to do, that's fine. You know,
right.
They have to live.
It's personal
they
choice.
Live with the responsibility of it. I don't care if someone else wears it. For me, it's like, I don't want to wear certain things because I don't want someone to ask me about it because I just don't want that conversation because, frankly,
dude, that's like a huge part
frankly,
of it, isn't it?
The world is fucking deeply boring to me and I am not interested in engaging with most of it. So I'm not giving some random fucking asshole a window of opportunity to start talking to me on the fucking subway.
Dude, I actually,
you're not getting the opportunity.
I've developed this weird habit over the last like 7 years of living, you know, out here with my wife where I'm wearing band shirts a lot more nowadays, but like there was a period for years where I was wearing less and less band shirts while I was home. Cause I don't want to fucking talk to anybody. And like, I would get so bummed out if I went to a family function or any kind of, you know, social function that wasn't just my friends, where someone would be like, Dylan here, he's a musician. He tours. And I'm just like, God, I know this is like, so shitty of me, but like, can you please never bring this up again? Because it makes me cringe. Because I feel like even having to talk about your subculture or like your tours or whatever is like such a douchey look.
I do not talk about it. Please don't ask
me about it.
I don't talk about music at work. Like, I don't talk about, some people know I make music, but not many, and I don't tell them much, but I've definitely had jobs where no one has known I'm a musician, and because I don't want the fucking conversation.
It's comfortable,
like,
because
I don't want that conversation.
Do you ever feel like, okay, so sometimes this is the vibe I've had in my head too, with someone that's like completely removed from like the subculture of extreme music, I don't want to explain it to them. And I also feel like I'm patronizing them if I try to explain it to them.
Yes.
I almost feel like I'm like some fucking dickhead elitist that's trying to explain to you a world you don't know, that a world that doesn't fucking matter, that doesn't make me any better than you. But it's so painful on multiple levels.
Okay, okay. Let me guess. It's like this. Someone goes, "Oh, what kind of music do you play?" And you go,
"It's like metal, but like, free jazz,
it's like noisy stuff." I don't know. You probably won't know any of it. And they go, "No, I probably will. You don't know that. Name something." And you go,
"Dude,
and you
try it's the
and
worst.
Name, and you try and name like something that's so fucking obvious. You like just, well, maybe they've heard of this. You're like, I don't know, like Discharge. You know, like, you know,
yeah, and even that's not a base for anyone I would talk to.
Because what am I going to say? Oh yeah, like Crossed Out, No Comment, and Grief, and like, what? And they go, "No, I haven't." Name something else. And like, oh fuck. And so then he's like, "Slayer, have you heard of Slayer?" And they go, "Yeah." And you go, "It's kind of like that,
but infinitely dumber."
yeah, it's kind of like that, but doesn't make any money, and it's it's fucking stupider.
So why do you do it? And then, I don't know. I don't even want to go there. I really don't, and because I really don't like. I really don't like elitism at all. Like, especially on a personal level. Like, I just have no right to act like that towards anybody, and it kind of grosses me out. So like, the last thing I want to do is attempting to be kind, trying to explain this to someone and coming off as like a douchebag. And I really, really, really don't ever want to talk to anyone about how I pretty much just am playing music for a living nowadays. Cause it's just like, it's not a badge of honor. It's just kind of like what I love. I love what I'm doing, and it's really, really amazing, and I'm grateful, but it's nothing that I want to even like have the shadow of a brag. I just don't want to, I'm proud of it, but it's for me. It's not for, you know what I'm trying to say?
Absolutely. And that goes,
it's like
back
you're
to
killing your own humility
about,
by talking about it.
Yeah, that's it's like what it goes back to what I was saying about there needs to be a certain level of initiation, because if there isn't, you then have to explain.
There's context, no reference point.
The context and the parameters, and people are just like, people have no idea. But why the fuck would they? They haven't grown up in this, like it makes no sense. And I don't want to come across as a sneering, condescending douchebag. And this is like, I'd rather just avoid those conversations.
It. When Full of Hell's in a group and we're all like at the airport or something, if some guy's like, "Oh, you guys play some music?" And obviously then I make the self-sacrifice to embarrass myself and be like, "Yeah, I play in a dumbass metal band." And like, you know, be kind. But like, generally it's just like, no offense, I don't want to talk about it. And that's so ironic to me, kind of, because like, ever since I was a little kid, all I wanted to do was be in a band. And it's like the thing I'm most proud of, and like, and I love it every moment of it, actually. But it's ironic, because I don't know. I don't want to talk about it.
but you don't want to talk about it when you're in Target or Walmart.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk it when I'm on the subway. Like,
do you think there's like there's a cultural thing there where like everybody assumes because you're in a band, like there's like this weird mainstream thing, like rock star culture. And it's so like vomit inducing, and it's just not us or anybody that's in a fucking band. Really, we're all just like guys.
It's certainly not
normal people.
Level.
Yeah, it's just like, I don't know, and it makes me extremely uncomfortable if I'm put in a situation where anybody ever assumes that that's not the case. And that's when you get people talking shit on bands. It's weird to me now, because it's like, that guy is just he's just a dude with like, he's just like a 40-year-old man with like a couple kids, and like he just wants to live his fucking life. Like,
yeah.
He loves his band and he's having fun. Like, can't you just say it sucks and then move on? Like, why waste all this energy on it? Like, it's just a human being like you who happens to be playing music.
Yeah, I love playing music, and music has been the most important thing in my life. And I love it, and I love the relationships and friendships I have through music. The strongest, most meaningful relationships I have with people are all through music. And the hardest thing for me as an aging musician is I don't tour really anymore, and it is more difficult to see people that I have established friendships with over the years. So I don't ever want to sound like I'm like complaining about music because I fucking love it, but I think people have these ideas about it. And okay, let's be honest, being on tour is really fucking boring. Like, it's not fun. It's actually really boring. And you and I have both traveled the world, but we've seen it from the back of a transit van.
Dude, it's so brutal sometimes when you think about it.
I've been to so many countries, and like, what have I seen? I've seen like a gas station, and I've seen a vegan restaurant.
We've probably paid, I think I've played Paris probably like close to 10 times at this point, and I've never been to the Eiffel Tower. And that's partially because I'm like I'm going to spend fucking money to travel across the city to see the Eiffel Tower. Like, I just don't feel like being a tourist. Because we're not there to be a tourist. Yeah. We're there to play shows.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, obviously I love touring, but it's incredibly dull for sure. I mean, it has its moments where it's just a slog. Boring. Like, I would never, I don't really want to ever bring my wife on tour because it's just like, it's not fun. What the hell is she going to do on tour? Oh, okay. We're all going to sleep in a Motel 6 hotel room tonight. We're sharing one room because, you know, I want to make more money. So you and me are going to sleep on the floor next to the roach trap. Like, that doesn't sound fun.
Yeah.
Or we're going to sleep, like, at 30, I really feel weird. I can't really be asking 18-year-olds if I can sleep on their parents' floor anymore. But, like, even years ago, it would just be like, we're going to sleep in this kid we met 2 minutes ago's floor. Like, that's just not something she would ever enjoy. But it's at the same time, I mean, I still love touring. I can't wait to go back on tour after this is over. Uh-huh. Honestly, I'm going to probably, you know, it's going to feel like being reborn again, because, you know, after feeling burned out for like a little while, I'm like really inspired for the last couple of years. And like, I don't know, my energy was like peaking right around the time this started. So I'm excited to get back out.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't know. I can't get enough. I'm like a glutton for it. I'm sure it says something about narcissism and all kinds of bullshit.
But it's your job. But it's your job, though, right? And it's.
I mean,
fun,
I guess.
It's how you have these connections with people.
Technically, it's a job, and
yeah,
I know. Like, we use that defense sometimes when people are getting lazy and not doing, you know, holding up their own. Like, this is a job. Please take it seriously. But honestly, if it felt like a job, truly, I don't know if I would do it. Like, it doesn't feel. It's hard fucking work. Especially, I end up usually, unless we're in Europe nowadays, as of very recently, I was always the tour manager type guy, because, you know, Spencer's like de facto leader, but I'm kind of like the guy that's willing to talk to whoever and get the money we need to get and sell the merch or fold the merch or order the merch. That's a lot of different shit to coordinate. Yeah, which thankfully I've literally never done once. There was like one situation. Dude, there was one situation.
I did it in Poland once.
Oh my God, dude, we've done some shit in Europe for sure. Europe is the only place where I've ever had altercations with promoters. The one time was in, I think it was Italy. But the promoter was wasted and the guarantee was really tiny. It was us and Disciples of Christ. It was a really tiny, very, 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 very reasonable guarantee. And the promoter was just like wasted by the end of the night. And it was a fun show. And then when he came to pay us, he paid us like, I don't know, maybe 60% of the guarantee. And he's like, I don't have anything else. And I was like, okay, you sure you can't get us the rest of the money? And it was not a lot. And he was like, no, there's no more. I don't know. And I was just like, I've got Chris Moore. And I was like, dude, what do we do? And he's like, I don't know. What can we do? And I was like, fuck, I guess we can just lecture him. And I was just like, look, buddy, like, we're really nice people and we're not going to, like, you know, gouge you for the 70 euros that you owe us or whatever the fuck little amount it was. But like, the next band that comes might kick your ass if you don't pay them. I'm just telling you, this is advice. And then he started crying.
Oh, God.
And I was just like, fuck you, man. Like, don't fucking sit here and cry. I'm being so nice to you, and I'm in the middle of, like, one of the dreariest tours I've ever been on in my life.
Yeah.
And you're stinging me over, like, a handful of dollars. And I'm just trying to explain to you that, like, if you're going to keep booking shows like you're obviously doing, just be careful. I was really nice about it. And then this guy just made it more torturous to me. And I just remember being like, this motherfucker's testing me, like just trying to just torture me and twist the knife a little more. And I felt so bad because this guy's crying and drunk. You know, one thing I was always interested about, I wanted to ask you about, what do you think brought, like, bridged the gap for you between the music that you've made over the years and hip hop?
I did a podcast about 6 months ago, maybe, called Take a Wide. Steve from Gruber, and I think he's in The Great Sabatini. I think that's another band he's in.
Oh, yeah.
A bunch of bands. Cool. It's his podcast. He's an awesome dude. And we really got into it in there. I don't want to repeat too much of the stuff that's in that one. But hip hop was the music I was first into when I was much younger, like, you know, before even being a teenager. The first truly DIY thing I ever did was at age 15 in 1988, setting up a pirate radio station with a bunch of my school friends, and we played
so hip-hop. Sick.
And for me, the real shift was I'd always been a fan. I'd had less ability to be as immersed in it as I'd like to be, because, you know, when you're playing in, like, grindcore bands and, like, doing noise stuff, is like, really, how much information in the world can you take on if you have, like, a functioning adult job as well? So it's like, I can only know so much stuff. Like,
yeah,
so,
it's an ocean.
And, like, some of it, a lot of it became very superficial, but as the years went on, I was always into hip hop, and like I said, I started to record myself, and every time I was testing out new things, because it wouldn't be like, hey, Eric King, come over and set your drums up and play a blast beat and I'll test it out.
Yeah.
It would be like, well, let me just sit here and make a beat of something. So I would do that. And then eventually, in my, how old am I? I'm 46. So maybe about 3 years ago, I thought, I still love being a musician and I love doing music, but I don't really like playing shows anymore. And it's just because it's a lot of dead time, and time as you get older it becomes more and more valuable. So don't like playing shows so much anymore. I don't really have the ability to play in a band and do a lot of it and become popular, and it's okay. It doesn't bother me that the music I play currently is not super popular, certainly not compared to some of the previous things I've done. I'm okay with that, but I also don't have the time to build up that kind of momentum again. So I was thinking, well, how can I still keep making music, but it be pleasing to me, but not having to go through playing shows and stuff. And so, well, maybe if I got into more production stuff, and I'd been listening to a lot more hip hop again, I'd gone through, you know, those phases that we all go through where listening to metal bands was deeply, deeply disinteresting to me for a while. And we'll go through those phases. Right now, I'm quite interested in a lot of metal right now, particularly shitty gore grind bands. But I was going through that phase, and I was like, well, maybe I should try doing this. And I made that shift into doing hip hop stuff. Stuck at it, and then, you know, started producing for a few local people and then a bit further afield, and that's kind of how I've got there. The switch was interesting. Like, the thing that helps me is I know how to talk to people because I'm an adult now. Like, if I was doing this at, you know, in my 20s, my social skills were not always the best. So I know how to talk to people. I know how the economics of music works, and I know how the mechanics of music work. So I didn't have to relearn some stuff. I had to unlearn certain habits and patterns, though. And also, like, the way you talk to people in hip-hop is not the way you talk to people in metal bands or hardcore bands. You have to approach it differently. So that was a reconfiguring it. And, you know, just that kind of a thing. It was, but it's, you know, I'm an adult. I can work through these paths. That took a little bit of time to do, but I can see the issues and the paths I had to take. So that was my, that was kind of how I got. Did I answer your question? I don't know if I did.
It was all really natural.
Yeah, it wasn't. I mean,
it seems like it.
Yeah, it was something I was into anyway, and I want to keep producing music, making music. I want to. It's something I love doing. I enjoy doing it, even if, you know, I most of the music I make, no one ever hears it. And it's all, that's always been the way. I've always made more music at home than I've actually released. But I find it really enjoyable. And I like that I can put effort into the hip hop stuff, but it can be here and there. You know, I can do it, you know, for an hour before I go to bed at night. And it's like writing albums in hip hop is not like, you know, in Intensive Care or Column of Heaven or Endless Blockade or any of the other bands been, and it's like, it's not like I sit at home playing the bass and then I go, well, how does this part gonna go and how's this transition go, and then I play it to the drummer and then he learns and then you play it to this guy and then you all have to get together and rehearse it constantly and keep changing it. You can literally do the drum pattern and go, oh, the drum pattern's done now. I don't
have and then find rehearse, a hook.
I don't have to rehearse it for like a year and then go and record it with 10 other songs to make it worth our while.
Right,
like you can just do it that like on the spot. So the momentum builds up quite quickly with the back catalog of work, because making an album in hip hop can take a week. I mean, it takes me longer than that, but you know, it's not like having to write all these songs and having to teach them to someone else and having to learn them and having to play them live and then recording them. Like you just, they're done as you go.
Do you think like someone like Justin Broderick programming drums like so early on in extreme metal had like an impact on you, like as far as like wanting to put samples into music and stuff like that? Like his ideas about sampling to me are just like, really, for me at least, it was like a pretty big deal. But
no, he didn't. And the reason is Justin and I I think he's maybe a couple of years older than me.
Oh, so he's your peer anyway.
Yeah, but my musical life before hardcore and grindcore and harsh noise was hip hop and going to like illegal raves in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Is it Slave State? Is that the Godflesh song that they when that came out, I was very excited because like, oh, that guy actually gets it, because he was sampling a Stacker Humanoid, which was like a huge acid house track. And I was like, that's cool that Godflesh, because I was a huge fan of Godflesh and Napalm Death and Carcass and all the early Eric stuff. But I was also like going to fucking raves and dropping ecstasy.
So
and
then you see this guy that like fucking gets it on a level that you didn't know, and maybe I was like, that's
kind of cool, because all my friends that I was going to like raves and stuff with, they were into that stuff and I was straddling a couple of different worlds. And for me, that's the thing that I made me very interested in how Broderick was approaching things, because it wasn't like this touristy kind of dropping in and out. And then there's a song on an album later on where he samples Digital Underground and other stuff. And yeah, like I don't know, like he's very genuine with it, and his way of putting it into his music has been quite seamless. Like Mick Harris as well has done similar things. Like I really like those. I like those early Scorn records, which are these weird kind of noise rock things with samples in. And then I really like the later era Scorn stuff, which is the really heavy dub stuff.
I mean, I love those guys bridging the gap. I feel like there's a lot of parallels between just like, you know, the electronic music world and our world and hip hop and like our quote unquote our world. And I loved even seeing like hip hop guys even nowadays, like the really DIY ones that clearly know how to hustle just like a DIY punk band, and like that's how they're making all their money. It's just really sick. I covered like 10 different examples of the same idea, but I love all the parallels between the two. And it's really funny, even nowadays that's a thing. I think like, I'm sure like this is pretty obvious, but I feel like all of this stuff's like pretty cyclical. So like a new batch of kids that weren't around to experience Godflesh at first, you know, they're seeing a band like The Body, who's like really psyched on a lot of pop and hip hop. And like, as far as their production goes, like Machines with Magnets is always like finding ways to wheedle in like, you know, like cool little pop inflections or like trap hats or something into Body music. And I think
Machines with Magnets is the studio that The Body record at in Providence.
And you know, Seth Manchester, incredible producer. And I just feel like it's really neat, because someone like my little sister, who's really into EDM and rap, she like, it's an easy base point where she's like, oh, I understand The Body and I understand Full of Hell now. Because I get these like programmed drum sounds, and this track's almost dancey. Like that's really cool. And I don't know, man. It all just like, the body definitely pulled me more into wanting that kind of stuff in my own music, for sure. It's just, it's interesting to see, like, generationally, I think there's, like, it seems like there's, like, you know, new crops of bands that are doing that same kind of idea that Justin was doing.
Yeah, I'm doing. I'm very excited still about music, and I'm very I love the era that we're in right now, because, like I said at the start of this conversation we're having, that these lines are blurred a lot more now. And let's just look at this playlist. You know, there's like Apartment 213 and Kickback and Sacrilege and Napalm Death on it, but then there's like fucking Ben Salisbury's on it, King Cruel, Shangri-La's, Herman
Cole. Yeah, like stupid, like, post-club music.
A ton of hip-hop stuff. King Tubby, and that's not weird in this day and age. And I do like that we can do that. It's funny, I always said, when I started recording my own stuff, when we really started doing that in Column of Heaven, one of the influences that I had, people were also going, oh, the noise is so crazy in Column of Heaven. But the noise influence in Column of Heaven was not noise acts. The noise influences in Column of Heaven was actually Public Enemy production, like an old Bomb Squad productions, where they would really layer up sounds and they would cut it in and out on the beat. And if you listen to those Column of Heaven, those recordings, like, it, the noise comes in on like the start of the bar and ends at these certain parts, and it was my way of filling up the sound. It's like, yeah, I'm an old 90s noise head, and I listen to a lot of that kind of stuff, but I'm not doing that because I want a Masana influence in there. The influence of that is from a very old style of hip-hop production. Like, people don't do that style anymore, but that's where that came from. And with Intensive Care, a lot of the approach that Bloomer I take in the post-production and the mixing comes from late 70s and early 80s reggae production, like King Tubby and Scientist. Like, we don't sound like that at all. It doesn't sound anything like that. But the ideas they were doing with how they would process sounds and remove layers and then add layers, like, these are the influences that we have and are informing it. So, Column of Heaven was influenced by hip hop in a really weird roundabout way, though. Because I was so obsessed with those old Public Enemy and Bomb Squad productions, like the first Ice Cube record and all the other records that the Bomb Squad put together, like how they were made. And I can still listen to them and like the fucking incredible amount of work and layering and detail that's gone into them. And that's where that came from.
Great production is great production. Would you say like some of those like tricks or tools used to kind of like make things flow better were almost more like utility than like, I don't know, like a noise track that you'd find on like some modern band that has noise, just to have it?
My motivate, I can't talk about other people's motivations for why they do things, but yeah, mine were sometimes, I don't know, I tend to fill everything up as much as I can. And a great thing of working with Bloomer from Intensive Care is that he is kind of taught me a lot to minimize a lot of the stuff that I do, because I tend to overcook things sometimes. And that's a trick I've had to unlearn in hip hop, because I can't, like, all my earliest beats were just garbage and there was too much going on in them. And now it's like, yeah, okay, let's pull this back a lot.
A lot of my favorite hip hop, some of the, that's on this list, definitely, is simplistic. Like, it's like a very simple beat and then like maybe a tiny little hook and then just, dense bars over top of it.
Yeah, and I mean, in my own production, like, if some of the material, I'm working on a lot with Falcon Outlaw, but of the two songs that are public, one is Trigger and Got No Heart from a year ago, and then Iron Man Suit that just came out a couple of weeks ago. Like, you can hear it in those. Like, Trigger is very, I wouldn't say it's overly busy, but there's a lot going on, and I'm playing all the instrumentation on it. But then Iron Man Suit is sample based and it's very simple. It's quite raw.
I like how dialed in it is.
Yeah, it's and I do both of those styles, like depending on what a person wants and depends on what kind of beat they want. So I can do more complex stuff, but I can also just be like, yeah, here's like a 2-bar loop and I'll chop it every fourth bar. But yeah, it depends what's required. But I mean, Bloomer's,
I think it's really hard,
and hip hop has definitely helped me minimize things because I do overthink things.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to, I think this applies maybe a little more to like noise, but I think it's hard for me to understand when is enough, you know, when I'm not even sure what my own parameters are to begin with. And I think like if I was to jump into, that's mainly my problem with, because I'm not very good at recording. I just kind of like have made do over the years, you know, when I need to record vocals, I can do that kind of thing. But as far as like making my own projects, I never know. I think I just have trouble focusing the laser. Like it's, and then when you get something that's decent, you know, because you're uncomfortable with it, sometimes you just want to like keep layering, and it's just, it becomes a muddied mess, and it's not focused. And I really think focus is important.
I work best with another person. Like I can work solo, but solo takes me forever.
Makes sense.
I prefer working with a person, either collaborating like the thing I'm doing with Mike from Uniform right now, or collaborating in like terms of a band sense. It's best for me when I have another voice there, talking me out of my stupid ideas sometimes.
Yeah, seriously.
I do definitely need that personally. Otherwise I never finish anything.
It's so much easier to be in a band with a bunch of people. Definitely. Because at least you have like the opportunity to like talk about it as a group or bounce your ideas off of others and like actually get some perspective. Because you can just get, I just get lost in my head basically. Like I've probably recorded like you know a good handful of like electronic demos over the years, different styles. Mm-hmm. But at the time I was like really psyched and I bury myself in it for days, and then I'll go on tour. And I'll come home and I'll be like, this shit sucks. And it just, you know, goes into the hard drive and never touched again. So many times.
Yeah.
Every year, pretty much.
The best when I'm producing hip hop, particularly when it's for someone rather than when I'm just making a batch of beats, the best way I found to do it is to work on it. And then I get stuck. And then I go, okay, I'm just going to leave this alone. And then I'll come back to it the next day. And then I hear it. Like if I've spent 5 hours trying to edit a sample.
It's to cleanse your brain.
I don't want to get rid of it. But then if I listen to it 2 days later and I go, yeah, that sounds like shit. It doesn't matter because I haven't just spent that last 5 hours. And I'm like, oh, fuck, I don't want to lose it. So for me, I kind of need that space between the initial spark of making something and finishing it.
I mean, that makes sense. Got to cleanse your palate. Food's the same way, man. Food. I really feel like some dishes are meant to be complex and that's cool, but like a lot of food that's great needs to have like, you know, a handful of ingredients that speak loudly and have their voice in the dish, you know, and music's the same way. Sometimes simplicity is literally all you need. Like when you're talking pizza, that's like the ultimate peasant food. It's a few ingredients and they just have to be very high quality and they have to speak loudly and there you go. You have a great pizza.
It's gotta be the right asparagus and lobster and
what the fuck kind of pizza?
The right.
No, you need American cheese, ketchup and white bread. they serve pizza at the country store near my house. And, I mean, I like it because I like really shitty ass pizza, but like it's a step above ketchup and American cheese. It's interesting. It's not like, you know, I would, it's a stretch to call it pizza.
I feel like that should be the end of this podcast. You talking about shitty pizza.
And get out of here.
Captain?
What is it, Lieutenant?
I'm getting some very strange reports from sea level.
In what way strange?
Holy Mountain Printing Podcast.